Welcome in to the Locked On Nets podcast. We are back, the full team in action for the first time in 2 weeks, talking the Nets acquisition of Jared Dudley. Going over one more time, this time with myself, the trades of Jeremy Lin out of Brooklyn, Kenneth Faried into Brooklyn, and finally wrapping this one up, talking about the Nets rotation now that their roster is all but set heading into the 2018-19 season. All that and more next on the Locked On Nets podcast.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Thanks for tuning in, Wednesday night edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. I am your host, Gavin Shaw. After 3 years covering the Phoenix Suns, I moved back to my native New York to cover your Brooklyn Nets. And then I went to Europe for 2 weeks. I abandoned the beat. I did not take the traditional NBA beat reporter vacation, which I think ideally starts in late July and ends before August 15th. I shot my load a little early, went at the beginning of July to the end of July, and I had a great time checking out London, Athens, Rome, and Barcelona. Josh knocked out a great solo pod while I was gone, and I'm still running on very little sleep. The time difference has meant that I've woken up at 5 in the morning the last 2 days, but I'm pretty happy with life. It was a great trip, and I'm very excited to get back into basketball. Josh, I got excited just like reading about the Nets today and like thinking about watching this team next year with the bench they've built and the guys they've acquired. I'm legitimately hyped for Nets basketball. So your magic has officially worked.
Yeah, no, I'm happy you're finally on board. It only took bribing you with a 3 week trip to Europe to get you there.
Yeah, you did cover it for me and all of our other friends. So I do appreciate that. Speaking of big-time payments, the Nets acquired the relatively significant salary of Jared Dudley and a top 35 pick from the Phoenix Suns at the price of Daryl Arthur, who would have been bought out and or cut if not for the trade. So they didn't really give anything up. And following the Jeremy Lin trade, they had the cap room to get Dudley, a veteran who remains an elite three-point shooter, who hit 39.6% of his threes for his career, 33 years old, clearly past his prime. Josh, what did you think of the acquisition?
I think it was a good trade for the fact that Dudley is a better player than Daryl Arthur. Dudley, even though he's really gone downhill a little bit, one, he's a good veteran leader, and his team still perform better with him on the court. He can still be a decent stretch for kind of be an upgrade on at least Quincy Acey last year, because he is a credible three-point shooter, as you mentioned, 40% from three. For his career, he's not going to be expected to play a ton, but when he does, I think he can still contribute in limited minutes. And then getting the top 35 protected pick from Phoenix in 2021, it's an asset nonetheless. Who knows how good it will be? Listen, Phoenix could win the 2021 NBA championship.
Oh yeah,
I highly doubt that.
You got my hopes up.
You'd be happy about that.
I'd be ecstatic.
A not so closeted Suns fan. You're just kind of blatant with your Suns fandom.
Yeah.
But regardless, it's an asset, another pick to add to the cupboards. So in terms of swapping Arthur for Dudley, it's not going to make a huge difference, but getting that pick is a nice move by Sean Marks.
Yeah, and obviously just one more year left on his contract, so even though they're paying him, I think around $10 million this season, it's not necessarily something that is going to harm them long term. And yeah, I love Dudley just as a human being. I got to know him a little bit my senior year of college, which I believe was his first year in Phoenix. He was the guy I'd go to basically
first year post return.
Exactly. He was the guy I'd go to pretty much for every story I did, to the point like I probably like over interviewed him. But he's just such an intelligent basketball mind, and also a very strong communicator, because I feel like just about anyone who has a long career in the NBA, like, understands basketball on an extremely high level. But for a guy like that to not only know basketball on the level, but to have the ability to communicate it and to furthermore be genuinely enthusiastic about interacting with the media, I think is something that's extremely rare. And it's made Dudley, I think, beloved by journalists across the country and like NBA beat writers and broadcasters that he's interacted with, and also his fellow teammates, because he's just clearly a guy who's happy to joke around, but also by the combination of his work ethic and just how long he's been able to survive for a guy who even at the start of his career, much less at 33, had relatively limited athleticism and was always sort of a tweener, and evolved from a power forward in college to a dynamic three-point shooter in the NBA. He's just all about adaptability. And again, it's a testament to his personality that he lasts that long. So I think he brings a lot of positive elements to this Nets team.
It's funny that you mentioned that someone who's been in the league as long as he has just thinks the game on a very high level, because he was in the same draft class as Nick Young.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good call.
It kind of just proves your point.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I guess Nick Young's an example of, like, if you can shoot the basketball and survive on defense, there's always going to be value for you in the league. And I guess that was kind of Dudley's MO the last couple of years. It seems like, I think Young was a little bit younger when he came out and into the NBA, and like Dudley at this point, like, clearly, like, isn't quite the same guy defensively anymore. Like, he's still really smart, but was like also very obviously overweight last year, to the point of getting memed by Enes Kanter, which I would just assume is any NBA player's worst nightmare. And he did set a goal for himself this offseason to get down to 235. He's halfway there after finishing last season at 255, which is way too much for a guy who's not necessarily all muscle at this point, had a bit of a pot belly, but he got down to 245 already, trying to get down to 235. So I think that increased mobility will be a real asset for him. And part of the lack of shape last year was not only the fact that Phoenix was terrible, which probably disincentivized him from being in top-notch shape, but the fact that he wasn't really playing that much, didn't start a game for the first time, for the first time in his career, only averaged 14 minutes a night, so he's just not necessarily getting those minutes. And Josh, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this and whether or not he'll be a part of this Nets rotation, because what he said in his press conference today is that the Nets have described his role to him as playing a stretch four. And when the Nets wanted to acquire him 2 years ago before they got outbid by Phoenix, that's how they envisioned him playing. And to me, that puts him in direct competition with someone like Kenneth Faried for which one of those two is going to be a part of the Nets rotation and which one will only play significant minutes if there's an injury.
I think that, first of all, going back to the weight point, I'm surprised that his weight got that high in Phoenix, because I visited you out there and the food options are pretty sparse. So I'd hate to see what's going to happen to him in Brooklyn, but hopefully he gets back on track. And in regards to rotation, I think that I would assume he's going to get the playing time over Kenneth Faried. We'll see how much that is, just because, as we know, Sean Marks and Kenny Atkinson love their three-point shooters, love to have the floor stretched. So, especially at center position, Jared Allen's still working on his three-point shot. Ed Davis plays closer to the basket. They're going to want four perimeter players on the court at all times joining those guys. And I think it just makes more sense to have Dudley play those stretch 4 minutes as opposed to Faried. And maybe Faried cracks into the rotation if there's, God forbid, an injury to Jared Allen or even Ed Davis. He can play some backup five, but I would assume he starts the year out of the rotation.
Yeah, no, I'm generally with you on that. And I think Dudley's pretty clearly an upgrade over Quincy Acey in that he just has a longer track record of being an excellent three-point shooter. Again, a guy who shot 39.6% for his career, which is pretty ridiculous. And in his prime, was one of the best three-point shooters in the NBA. You go through some of his best seasons in Phoenix. His first time around, shot 46% from three back in 09, 010, 42 the next year, 38 after that. And then since then has consistently kind of hovered between 36 and 42. Last season, down to 36, but again, didn't get quite the same number of attempts he was used to in recent years. So maybe struggled to get into rhythm because of that. I think this Nets offense can generate some really good looks for him. And again, I think he's smart enough defensively to survive. And if Jared Allen takes a step forward that we hope, he's going to be playing behind potentially a very solid rim protector. So I think he really is an ideal fit. And what I also kind of like about his game is he's just not a guy who needs the basketball. Like, he's just such a pure spot-up shooter. And I thought one of the Nets' biggest problems at times last year was, despite their relative lack of talent, they had a lot of guys whose offensive games were oriented around having the basketball and either being able to attack one-on-one, or in the case of Allen Crabbe, trying to dribble their way into threes. And Dudley, I think at this point in his career, is really just a pure catch-and-shoot guy who still has the ability to make smart passes and move the ball around. I think he's just going to be very good for the Nets' equilibrium on offense, and I think defensively he's still smart enough to, if not be a positive, at least not be unplayable on that end of the floor. So I think that and everything you put out there makes him a pretty clean fit for this Nets team. All right, so with that, we will take a quick break on the Locked on Nets podcast and come back talking about the Jeremy Lin and Kenneth Faried trades, which Josh already touched on, but I wanted to give my thoughts and ask Josh a few more questions on his analysis of those two deals. Yeah, so the Nets, of course, they have a pretty quiet offseason, and then I go to Europe, and almost immediately the Nets, they acquire Kenneth Faried, they trade Jeremy Lin to the Atlanta Hawks. I was getting all these belated NBA updates in Europe. I chose to go without any kind of data plan. I wanted a pure experience, and then I just end up spending like 3 hours on my phone every morning when I woke up, catching up on everything I missed. And inevitably, I got home 2 days in a row, and the Nets had made these giant, I guess franchise-altering moves a little bit strong, particularly for the Kenneth Faried one. But I don't know, trading away Lin feels like a big deal just because he was kind of considered their best player going into last season. And there was this whole, obviously we put like a lot of emotion into his injury and him coming back this year. And I was really excited to watch him play. And like, I remembered how good he was at the end of the 2016-17 season. And I don't know, it was just kind of a gut punch to see that he was dealt. But logically, it made a lot of sense. And the fact that they got a first round pick out of it was really exciting.
Definitely. Yeah, I think it does mark a change for the organization simply because in the past they brought in guys like AK-47 to kind of stimulate that Russian fan base, and even making the KG and Pierce trade, a lot of it was to make that big splash. Now trading the guy who's far and away their most popular player, one of the more popular and well-known players in the league, I mean, it does mark a sign that obviously Sean Marks has been doing this since he took over for about 2 years now, but he really is doing what's for the best of Brooklyn Nets as a basketball organization. And hopefully if they're good, that's going to coincide with the business part, but he's not just doing it to make money.
Right. And it was fascinating because I read a whole article kind of conflating it with the DeRozan trade, and the article like wisely pointed out that the facts were totally different. Like Lin, obviously at no point in his career, even close to the same caliber player as DeRozan. It's not like he spent his whole year in Brooklyn. In fact, he only ended up playing 37 games in a Nets uniform. But again, just going back to his time as a Knick, like he's obviously developed this incredibly loyal fan base in New York, does everything right on and off the court. Like there's a reason he's so utterly beloved, and the response to Marks trading him was kind of pure venom from fans on social media. Like people were calling him like a snake and that he cheated Lin, even though like by all accounts, like from both Lin and Marks, like Marks was like totally transparent with him and said like, hey, look, like the rumor that you're going to OKC didn't really have that much credibility, but like we are trying to trade you to Atlanta. So it sounds like everything was done the right way. And I on the bright side for Lin, like Summer League, if it showed anything about the Hawks, it was that Trae Young isn't ready to be a starting point guard in the NBA. So he's a real opportunity there with a young team with quite a bit of shooting around him and quite a bit of athleticism around him to make an impact, to dominate the ball, and I guess play the way that he's played when he's been at his best in the NBA in Atlanta versus the Nets, where there's this whole giant logjam at point guard. So I like the way it worked out. I mentioned before, I like that it lets them acquire a first round pick. And I guess this is the third note of the Nets acquisitions. Like I kind of like Shabazz Napier as a lower cost replacement for him.
Yeah, I love bringing in Shabazz and kind of getting probably more production when you think about the injury risk associated with Jeremy Lin as opposed to what's associated with Shabazz Napier at a lower cost. And I think Lin's, yeah, as you mentioned, he's in a pretty good situation. Trae Young's not ready to take on a huge workload yet, even though there'll be some growing pains. It might make sense for him to play a lot and just get some of that development curve started, but he can still play alongside Trae Young because Lin can play both the one and the two. And Atlanta has, their roster actually could be decent in a few years. I really like John Collins. They have guys like Torian Prince on the wings. Bazemore's a guy that struggled a little bit, but he has talent. And Lin's definitely going to be looked on to be the leader there and play 25 to 30 minutes a game if he's healthy. So he has an opportunity to rehabilitate his career after two injury-plagued seasons with the Nets. But I think both sides are better off at this point just because with Spencer Dinwiddie, D'Angelo Russell, and Caris LeVert in the fold, even if Lin was healthy, he wasn't going to be getting the opportunity that he now will as a member of the Hawks.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And it's really exciting for Lin. It's really exciting for Brooklyn. And that trade was, at least to some degree, prompted by the acquisition of Kenneth Faried and Daryl Arthur, which obviously added quite a bit of salary for Brooklyn. And in return, the Nets got what is generally considered the most valuable generic asset you can get in the NBA, a 2019 first-round pick. It is protected 1 through 12. And then they also got a 2020 second-round pick that's utterly unprotected. And just given how difficult the Western Conference is, obviously, your expectation is that Denver would be on the rise over the next 2 years and they'd be really, really good in the next two seasons. But you never really know. So that could end up being a really valuable asset in and of itself. And this continues what's been a long-running trend now of the last three off-seasons of Sean Marks figuring out, or at least the last two, Sean Marks figuring out a way to turn essentially nothing into first-round picks just by taking on salary and then maneuvering his way out of paying luxury tax and maintaining enough flexibility for the 2019 offseason. So I don't want to like laud the guy's genius because I think you and I both agree like he's made his mistakes, but at least in that capacity, like his ability to get picks for a team that was so depleted and restock a cupboard of young assets that was essentially empty 3-4 seasons ago, I think has been pretty remarkable.
I think that's a good point, Gavin. And he's definitely keeping the flexibility for the Nets and has done an above-average job. I think the one thing I would say, though, is that right now it seems like everyone's gearing themselves up for this big 2019 free agency run. And what happens if we don't get anyone and now we're stuck with, let's say, we get the 10th pick this year, and now we're stuck with a team of guys like Caris LeVert and Jared Allen who are promising assets, but maybe D'Angelo Russell doesn't live up to his potential and still has a year where the Nets aren't sure if they're going to commit to him for the future. And now with no big free agents on the horizon, it's tough to know where the future of the team would be. So that's kind of crawling in the back of my mind as a worst case scenario. But even still, having all of your picks going forward, having some cheap assets and guys on short contracts, it does increase your flexibility. So Sean Marks has done I'd probably give him a B+, A- for his job with the Nets so far, taking them from just a abysmal, desolate situation 2 years ago to what they are now, where there is promise and people have a reason to kind of be optimistic about the future of this team.
Yeah, and this goes back to the Lynn deal, but I just love like I mean it's maybe it's a little harsh to say like utter lack of sentimentality, but he has this distinct vision. At least like I don't know if we know what the long or I guess not even the long term goals, but what the short term goals of his team are and how competitive they really expect to be next year. But it seems like he's really striking this perfect balance of acquiring picks and having young assets and having younger guys to develop while putting together a bench that, and we're going to get into this more next segment, that I really think could be one of the best in the NBA, and stalking the team with the right kind of veterans, like guys that don't cost too much on short-term deals but are going to be really great examples for the younger guys and contribute in positive ways, but not to such a degree that the Nets will win their way out of getting a top 10 pick. So I really, he's trying to strike this balance, and you're right, it kind of flips on whether or not they can get free agent next year and whether or not they hit their potentially top 10 pick next season. But just in terms of what position they're in right now, I feel really good about it. And I feel like if a couple things hit the right way, which, I mean, outside of the Warriors, what NBA team can you say like that doesn't have to happen for them to accomplish their goals? I think things look really, really good for Brooklyn.
Yep, things are looking up. And the one thing I am worried about for this upcoming season is that the Nets honestly might be too deep, where we're not going to be able to expose our young players as much and really see what they have and see if we have one or two true cornerstones of the franchise moving forward. Because as you mentioned, the bench is very deep. And probably 10 or 11 guys that could play on most rosters.
Well, you know what? Let's get into that next segment. We're going to be breaking down the Nets' full roster, their rotation, who's going to be in it, and maybe some initial thoughts on what the minute distribution could look like at each position. All that and more next on the Locked On Nets podcast. Thanks for joining us back on the Locked On Nets podcast. A quick correction: Josh rightly pointed out that I said Daryl Arthur. It is Darrell Arthur, and we'll see if he signs with a team after I pronounce his name wrong. How dare he? How dare he have a name that I didn't intuitively pronounce correctly? All right, Nets roster. Here are the guys. I just wrote out a list of guys that I thought could potentially play this season, and you can let me know your thoughts on this, Josh. Point guard, I had in order: D'Lo starter, Spencer Dinwiddie, primary backup. Obviously, there'll be sections of time where those two play together, or at least I assume there will be. Shabazz Napier as the third string guy, and I think same thing with him. There'll be sections of time where he plays alongside D'Lo and Dinwiddie, and the good thing about that is D'Lo and Dinwiddie are both big enough to guard shooting guards and might actually be better guarding shooting guards with their relative lack of quickness. All right, at the two, Crabb, then Caris LeVert, who will also get some time probably as a primary ball handler, but maybe that'll take an injury, and then Zanon Musa, who I don't know if he'll play. We'll see. And then small forward, Damari Carroll, Joe Harris, Rodions Kurix, whose name I'm probably still butchering, power forward, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, Jared Dudley, and then Kenneth Faried, center, Jared Allen, Ed Davis. Those are the guys that I think could potentially play. My biggest question is those two rookies and Faried. I think everyone else is pretty much a lock to be in the rotation.
Yeah, I think
maybe not Dudley.
There's a question about, yeah, Dudley versus Faried. What could be better, I think, is let's say neither of them play because RHJ is a starter at the four, and then Carroll is his primary backup, and obviously those two guys can play together, so maybe they're both getting 25, 28 minutes apiece. So that way Faried and Dudley don't need to play, and that would be a 10-man rotation of D'Lo, Dinwiddie, Napier, Crabb, Karras, Carroll, RHJ, and Jared Allen and Ed Davis.
Yeah.
If I'm adding those, that's a 9-man rotation.
Yeah, no, Joe Harris too. I think I don't know if you mentioned him.
Yeah,
you did. Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
so that would be 10 guys. I think that's fine.
Yeah,
I'm sure one of those 10 would be injured to start the year, knowing the Nets' luck. So it's very fluid. I really not expect either Musa or Rodions Kurix to break into the rotation, even in the first half of the year. Maybe post All-Star break, one of them surprises, but both those guys are, I'm assuming, we'll get some significant run in the D-League.
Yeah, and it's an interesting situation because I know before last offseason we were saying that last year could have potentially been almost a redshirt season for Jared Allen, and then he obviously surprised and was really impressive and ended up being one of the
Nets. Well, and Zeller were playing ahead.
Yeah, well, that's where I was going. Yeah, the competition's completely different. And the Nets, conversely, have, I wouldn't say one of the best because the frontline talent isn't anywhere close to being there, but one of the deepest wing rotations in the NBA, with all the point guards who can play up a position if necessary, and then Crabb, Karras, Carroll, Harris. There we go. The rhyming got me a little bit there. And then RHJ, who you could potentially describe as a three. I think he's going to mostly play power forward next season, as he did last year. But you just have all those guys, and I wonder where they mix and match, and if someone like Caris LeVert takes a step forward. Maybe he's clearly a better player than Allen Crabb is last year. Maybe like Allen Crabb's second half of the year performance is more sustainable than we think, and he ends up being like one of the Nets' two or three leading scorers. Carroll, like, you could make an argument. Like, I know we both ultimately said Dinwiddie, but you can make an argument that Carroll was the team's MVP this year, and advanced statistics would back you up on that. And then Joe Harris, we were saying it was one of the most efficient scorers in the NBA, and I like the way he works. I would expect him to take another step forward. So I'm really interested to see how those guys kind of sort out and who's playing where. And then Dudley, like, is clearly like not quite as good as any of those guys, but with his shooting, like, he kind of makes sense as a complementary piece more than like, say, playing Carroll and RHJ together. So I'm very interested to see how this plays out. I think you're right based on the Nets track record and based on the NBA in general over the course of an 82 game season. These questions usually sort themselves out, and there's almost never a team, like even the Raptors last year had such a good bench, there's almost never a team that has too many playable guys. Like it always ends up being with injuries, like either you're really deep or you're short a guy or two, but I can't really think of too many teams in recent NBA history where you're like, oh wow, they have that player on the bench who would be like a nice starter on another team. It just doesn't really happen with all the parity across the league. So even though it kind of looks like that for Brooklyn right now, I'm sure all of this will sort themselves out. The guys who are supposed to play will play. But right now, it just looks interesting. And on paper, they're one of the deepest teams in the NBA.
Yeah, they're a deep team, but also it's because their starters aren't differentiating themselves a lot from their bench.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, those two groups are pretty even. And kind of if there is a logjam, if people stay healthy, I wouldn't be surprised if maybe Dinwiddie, Napier, or Carroll, I'd say those are the three guys most likely to get traded.
Right. And I don't know, out of those three, like, on the surface, like, I'm like, all right, if you're going to trade one of them, like, do the same thing you did with Lynn and trade Carroll, the guy whose age trajectory doesn't make any sense. And I think Jared Dudley replicates some of what you get with Carroll. Obviously, he doesn't have the same off-the-dribble ability. I don't think he's quite as good defensively at this point, but he gives you some of the same stuff, and I think his acquisition makes Carroll a little bit more disposable.
I disagree with that.
Sure.
Because I think Carroll really is the heart and soul of the team. I mean, who else is going to steal the ball after the other team gets the rebound, like a signature play?
Right.
I think he just makes a lot of intuitive plays that not a lot of people do, and Dudley has the capability to do that. He's a very smart player, but he also just doesn't have the quickness or athleticism to execute on a lot of them.
Yeah, I'm with you. And maybe Joe Harris is that guy to some degree. Like, he was a guy, like, especially later in the year, was like sliding across the floor to get loose balls. I think Harris brings some of that from just an excitement perspective and an energy perspective.
Sure.
Yeah, and we still have quite a bit of time before the season starts, fortunately, so we'll get into it more. But I'm very interested to see what the Nets are doing with Spencer Dinwiddie next year, because again, if Karras takes a step forward, like, I think you'd want to put him on the ball a little bit more, and that further kind of alienates Dinwiddie as he sort of was in the second half of the year. But Josh, I'll give you the platform for some closing thoughts, and after that, we'll wrap this one up.
Yeah, I think the team looks good right now. It's a more complete roster than what we had last year, just because there is depth at the combo forward position. Guys like Dudley and Farid, even, who could play the four and the five, that might not be in the rotation to start the year, that we have in our back pocket. And then getting a very credible backup center in Ed Davis is going to be huge, because that was a huge weakness last year. Guys like RHJ and Damari were playing out of position, not to mention also Cunningham and AC needing to slide up to the five. And these guys aren't going to take as much of a beating as they did last year, hopefully. And then getting Napier, essentially, if you think of him replacing Lynn, well, Lynn played 30 minutes last year.
Yeah.
So getting Napier is going to be a huge upgrade, added depth to the point guard position. He's a pretty good playmaker, good all-around scorer. So he's going to give the Nets another option should injuries hit.
Yeah, I'm with you on all that, and I'm excited to get into it in the coming weeks. The offseason, incredibly quick. Free agency wrapping up. All these trades seem to be wrapping up post the Kawhi bomb dropping. So you're starting to get that feel that, like, NBA basketball's right around the corner again. So I'm ecstatic for it. Josh, I'll let you get going. Thanks so much for doing this with me. Excited to be back after 2 weeks off. And time to get excited for Nets basketball. We'll be back soon.